Dr. Sid Frankel from University of Manitoba, and he's going to be speaking to us about public health advocacy for basic income as a preventive policy influencing the social determinants of health. It doesn't get realer than that.
Thank you. Very pleased to be here, and hope I keep you awake at the bad time on a late afternoon. So I'm from the only Canadian province that had the only Canadian guaranteed annual income experiment. The experiment was a wonderful success. Implementation did not occur. That's the same story in the U.S. and wherever else in the world experiments were done. I'm hoping that this concept will be reinvigorated, at least partially on the basis that it influences one of the key determinants of health, or several of the key determinants of health, and there may be a rationale for this that was not explicated in the 1970s and 1980s. So I'm going to quickly deal with definitional issues. I'm going to bring you what evidence there is on health and educational effects, talk briefly about the labor supply effects, the great conservative bugaboo here, the fear that people would quit working or not work as much if there were a basic income. I'm going to talk briefly about how this could be paid for and what it might cost, and I hope I have time to talk a bit about the political barriers and to frame this a bit ideologically. So what are we talking about? A regular stream of cash income to every citizen. It ideally, a full basic income should be adequate to meet basic needs, however those are defined. It should be paid to individuals. It's differentiated from other forms of income transfer because it's universal, paid to all members of the political community, not based on any kind of categorical eligibility, not based on a means or a needs test. It is unconditional, not based on conditions of participation in the labor market or in education. And there are really two variants of this. The universal demigrants, so this is a cash payment to all members of the political community, and it may or may not be taxable. Of course, its affordability is greatly enhanced if it is taxable. There are not examples of basic incomes that have ever been tested of this kind. I'm going to tell you about one short trial. Then the more dominant form, a negative income tax that targets benefits to low-income individuals, and is highly administratively efficient because it is simply based on the tax return. What evidence of the health effects? My colleague Evelyn Forget, the original questions on the MINCOM, the Manitoba experiment, were about labor supply, fears of family splitting, and fears of increasing the birth rate. And none of those fears were demonstrated empirically, but Evelyn came back to this many years after and tried to look at the health effects. And her work is on a saturation site in Dauphin, Manitoba. Saturation in the sense that every man, woman, and child living in Dauphin between 1974 and 1979 were eligible to be a part of the experiment. The experiment was essentially a negative income tax with the top payment at 60% of Statistics Canada's low income cutoffs, of course varying by family size. Canada has no official poverty line. but one of the poverty measures that's published is the low income cutoffs. It's a semi-relative measure based on food, shelter, and clothing. And any income from any other source, earned or unearned, was taxed back at quite a high rate at 50%. So this was not a hugely generous experiment. It's a rigorous quasi-experimental design, an interrupted time series. Because we have a universal healthcare system, it provided a basis for selecting controls using propensity matching, and they were able to find four good controls for every experimental subject. Well, what do they find in terms of health? Just briefly, hospital separations fell by 8.5% relative to controls during the income period. Definitely statistically significant and quite a large effect, I would say. Most of the decline was based on mental health admissions and admissions for accidents and injuries. This lower level persisted till 1985, a number of years, 6 years after the end of the experiment, and then it actually quite quickly started to disappear. And no one thought of bringing the experiment back, unfortunately. A trial in India, in Madhya Pradesh, 8 randomly assigned saturation villages and 12 randomly assigned control villages. The intervention was a monthly universal demogrant. The experiment went on only for 12 months. And the benefit was set at 30% of the official poverty line in India. Again, not a highly generous benefit. Just looking at the health effects, a real difference between the intervention village households and the control households in terms of self-reported episodes of illness, which were at least 24 hours and required treatment but not hospital treatment, so you can see the difference between the households. Experimental households spent significantly more on medicines, doctor fees, and hospitalization, but we have to understand this in the context of a seriously inadequate public health system or public health service system. And the qualitative data from the interviews with the household showed that they saw this as one of the key benefits, one of the key ways, and not the only key way, they also used it for more food, etc., but one of the key ways that they did use the demogrant. Some indirect evidence, a systematic review of 13 and panel and longitudinal studies which focused on changes in income that resulted in changes in self-reported health, this time not changes in income based on an experimental benefit, but changes that occurred, as it were, naturally for other reasons. 10 of the 13 studies found a small, statistically significant positive effect of income increases on various different measures of health status. The studies didn't really account very well for measurement error, and many of them had insufficient power. The authors concluded that probably effects were underestimated. The size of effects were underestimated. More indirect evidence, so one of the pathways between income and health, of course, is through education. In the Dauphin experiment, this time looking at educational effects, during the experiment, grade 11 students were much more likely to continue to grade 12 than urban and rural counterparts. Before and immediately after the experiment, the grade 11 students went back to being less likely than the urban counterparts, and as likely as their rural counterparts. So an effect very clearly tied, in this case, I think, to the experiment. Educational effects were measured in some of the U.S., in two of the U.S. Guaranteed annual income experiments of the 70s, and one of them going into the 80s. And you can see the evidence there. You can see the labor supply evidence, so there was no massive effect in labor supply. And we have to understand that these were men not quitting work, but when they were between jobs, taking more time to find jobs, and women with children spending more time with those children. And of course, there's evidence that there are positive child development effects there. Cost, of course, it's driven by the adequacy of the benefit and the rate of crediting or taxing benefit income. The same is true for any benefit, regardless of its type. Harvey estimated that in 2003 it would have cost in the U.S. $826 billion after netting out the cost of redundant transfer payments to move everyone up to your official poverty line. There are a number of possible sources of financing. Everyone argues not to have a dedicated tax. It's too much of a target. General revenue, sovereign wealth funds based on resources or gambling. Alaska has such a benefit based on oil royalties. And an argument for economic rents on the Commonwealth, on commonly owned natural and socially created assets. Finally, the political barriers, the good and the bad. So this is very vexatious to the neoliberal state. So we have a neoliberal state, as Loic Wakant has put it, that's focused on labor market flexibility, desocializing labor, and making welfare benefits less attractive, more contingent. Well, this does the opposite. And there's an apparent consensus between the left and right. As you know, Milton Friedman was one of the supporters of a basic income, as were progressive economists. And of course, this consensus will fall apart as soon as the details emerge. What do we need? We need a robust coalition. Jürgen de Wispelaer and Noguera have analyzed the situation. The coalitions advocating for a basic income have tended to be cheap support, so supporters who just wanted their name attached. I hope Bernie Sanders isn't one of them, because he's mentioned basic income a number of times. Or simply don't have the resources for effective adequacy, or fractious support, supporters, mostly right-wing supporters, who alienate many other supporters. So this isn't helpful. Well, what's needed? A powerful, inclusive set of political agents inclined to provide long-term support. Are public health professionals and scholars part of this coalition? I hope so. Thank you very much.